Do you want me to stop?
Yeah, obviously, like every time.
Fine. Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, screaming into your internet echo chamber one painful episode at a time. My name's Jimmy and I voted to leave the EU in 2016.
And I'm Jazza, and I, like every year, am clinging to the Eurovision Song Contest as my last bandit and my last hope of being able to feel European again. I voted Remain.
Really?
Yeah, surprise.
And we actually found out that we're not going to leave Eurovision despite our departure from the EU.
I mean, yeah, that I would have started a revolt. I think stronger about being part of Eurovision than I do about being part of the EU or the single market or anything.
Genuinely?
I think genuinely. It's my Christmas. Every year, it's a brilliant like month of glitter and fantastic ridiculousness. And we get to hear from nations that we forget exist, like San Marino and Malta.
And, you know, such famous European nations as Australia
and Israel. Yes, and Israel, yeah.
Australia's, I guess, more legit, you know, because, you know, founded by white settlers, so...
Well, and Israel wasn't.
Were they mostly European?
I mean, literally, we created it.
I guess so, yeah. Mm-hmm. So should all, like, former colonies of, you know... of Europe be allowed to join Eurovision in future?
I mean, well, this was one of the arguments for the UK not joining the European Common Market in the first place. Like, what happens to all of the Commonwealth nations? Maybe that's a legitimate point. Should India have an entry? I'd be up for India having an entry into the Eurovision Song Contest.
At that point,
love a bit of Bhangra.
It just becomes world vision, doesn't it?
I am waiting for world vision.
Global vision.
Mm-hmm. I remember they did a one-time spin-off of pop idol franchise where all of the idol winners from across the world competed. And it was like Eurovision. They tried really hard to make it a thing. Like Kelly Clarkson took part in it with Will Young. And I think like the Dutch winner ended up winning the whole thing. And it only happened once because nobody cared about it. But I was so into it because it's the closest thing that we had to another Eurovision Song Contest.
It's like the World Cup of mediocre singers.
Oh, it was amazing. Loved it. So we meet every we meet every week
every time
we meet to talk about politics, social issues, and current events. We come at you this week again with three more topics. What are those topics, Jimmy?
Well, we might as well. We're not going to start with this, but Eurovision is, in fact, our third topic this week.
Uh-huh,
why are we talking about Eurovision?
There's been a wonderful intersection of all of the things that I find interesting. That is the Eurovision Song Contest, gay things, and China. So the Irish entry to the Eurovision by Ryan Shaughnessy has a LGBT theme, like there's two interpretive dancers on stage with him, and the music videos of two men dancing together. Lovely. They are really kind of hamming up the whole gay theme thing and trying to make it so that it looks like Russia are trying to stop them from being able to do anything. I mean, good for them. Otherwise, nobody would be talking about this really boring song. They wouldn't be in the final. But anyway, that's another thing. So the European Broadcasting Union, who are in charge of the Eurovision Song Contest, they have revoked the rights of the Chinese broadcaster, Mango TV, from being able to broadcast the Eurovision because they blurred out and blanked out rainbow flags and the same-sex dancers in the Irish entry. Mm. And so we're going to be talking a little bit about that, about the gay themes in the Eurovision, and also what it's like. China's kind of having a bit of a debate about at the moment about whether or not they want to be the next Russia when it comes to queer rights.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We also, if you're in the UK, you'll know that there were some local elections last week, week and a half ago.
Yeah.
Recently.
Early May.
Yeah, in early May. Depends on when you're listening to
Indeed,
this.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the results mean. Do you, Jimmy?
Do you remember what the results were?
Everyone kind of was asked to vote and went, oh, I don't really know, but no more UKIP, please.
So Labour gained a small amount of seats, 79. The Conservatives lost a smaller amount of seats, 35. And UKIP lost 123 seats. And the Lib Dems won 75 seats. So
Lib Dem fight back.
Lib Dem surge.
Yes.
Also, yeah.
The yellow wave, that's something else.
So The general interpretation is that the Tories and Labour are kind of stalemated at this point. The Lib Dems obviously appear to have done relatively well and UKIP did very badly. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of confirmed what we, I guess, already, what I at least already kind of thought
about.
You're
so insightful, aren't you?
I'm not that insightful. But it's roughly in line, I think, what you'd expect with general polling. But we'll discuss like the response to it and the attempts that people have made to add some interest into their analysis of what went on there.
Yeah, great. And then we're going to talk about, what did they call it?
The intellectual dark web.
The intellectual dark web, which is a really stupid metaphor. But do you want to explain what this is?
Yeah, so the New York Times published this opinion piece about the, quote, intellectual dark web, which is a, I don't know, you can't even really just call it a movement. I guess you could say it's a loose network of... Mm-hmm. Into like public thinkers who think that they're iconoclastic, you know, going against the grain, fighting back against various like politically correct taboos and
the main
promoting
thing is political correctness and identity politics, right?
Yeah, so they feel that certain conversations have become, say, around like you know, sex differences or, you know, disparities between racial groups in terms of like life outcomes. And a bunch of other things have been threatened because of the rise of identity politics. Mm-hmm. And so this includes people like Sam Harris, who is one of the new atheists, Jordan Peterson, who is...
Who we've talked about more than I ever really wanted to.
Well, yeah, who is kind of a self-help guru, but also a Canadian psychotherapist?
No, he's not. I don't think he'd call himself a psychotherapist. He's a psychologist.
Psychologist.
And has like a big... following of among like disenfranchised young white men.
Yeah, so there's a...
because he says a lot of like self-helpy things that they've never heard before.
So a lot of these people do have, I mean, somebody definitely described it as sort of the intellectual wing of the alt-right.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the article is quite interesting. I think the
it's
whole
from the New York Times.
New York Times, yeah. And I think it's kind of worth discussing what is the topic, at least, in there, and also the presentation that the New York Times has put upon it. So, that, you know, identity politics, it's one of our things.
It is. Whenever a story of this caliber comes up, we have to talk about it, because Jimmy likes making me annoyed. Right, so we'll go into our little spiel about Patreon and how we want you to give us money in a consensual way, obviously. And then we'll get on with the topics. Hello, dear listener, it's Jazza here. Just a quick reminder to say thank you to the guys who are supporting us on Patreon. We are completely a listener-supported podcast. And if you think that our work here is worth like a little bit of a tip, maybe like a dollar or so for each episode, then please go over to patreon.com/rightdishonorable and, you know, like, help us out. It really does make a difference when it comes to buying new equipment, hosting fees, and all of that kind of stuff. Also, it's nice to be validated by you guys. Thank you to the guys who are already supporting us, yeah, I guess that's it. On with the show. Right, Jimmy. I'm confused by the local elections slightly because there's just so many of them, and it's really hard to, because it's not all of the UK that votes in local elections, and it's only specific parts of it.
Mm.
And everybody seemed to think this one was a big deal, I think mainly because it was London that was voting, and that's where everybody is.
So there's London, some metropolitan, some various cities around the UK.
Yeah, so I voted in Oxford.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
And then just other just random odds and sods here and there.
Yeah, some of the Midlands.
Yeah. Right, yeah. And there are a couple of mayoral elections as well, like Lewisham voted for a mayor.
Yeah, we had one in Newham as well.
Yeah.
Great, good.
And so there are just a... It is quite sort of random because local elections sort of happen in cycles and it's never the case that all of them are up for grabs at the same time. And local government is also really complicated and tiered in weird ways.
Yeah.
Which I think actually...
They are really only in charge of like parking, potholes and bins.
sort of depends, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So like Greater Manchester, which is still like a local authority, has far more expansive powers mm-hmm. than the things you've just mentioned.
They also have certain powers in the NHS.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So apparently when going to the polls in London, 43% of people were thinking about Brexit when they came. 30-something percent were thinking about the NHS, which I do not think is for like local councils. That's like the London Assembly that would deal with those kinds of issues, I believe.
I don't know. Possibly.
And then the third thing was like bins. Like genuinely very local things.
Yeah.
And so that just, to me, makes it really clear that British people have no idea what the local elections are for.
Well, I couldn't even work out who was standing in my local constituency until I got to the polling booth. And it was like, oh, Renew are standing a candidate in this area.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, you know, the elite metropolitan Ramonas.
Mm-hmm. Our favourites.
Yeah. So who did you vote for in the end?
Who do you think I voted for?
Lib Dem all the way?
Obviously, yeah.
I also voted Lib Dem, but the Lib
Dems
continue to annoy me with their stance on Brexit.
But well, you knew what you were getting into.
Not enough to prevent me from voting for them, or, you know, for voting for Labour or the Tories.
Well, in the local elections, it's voting on whether or not you agree with the party stance on Brexit is pointless, because it's not going to affect Brexit in any way, shape or form. We talked about this on Twitter.
It
aiding the narrative of that party in their national like conversation. Even though I feel like the Lib Dems had the best night of all of the parties by a long, long way. They gained like 100 and something seats, you were saying.
No, they gained 75
seats. 75 seats. Which is the biggest gains after
Labour got 79.
Nobody seems to be talking about how well the Lib Dems did.
No, I think it's because they've, you know, many people have focused on the fact that Jeremy Corbyn did a bit underwhelmingly.
Uh-huh.
Because there were people, I mean, particularly Owen Jones and his kind of coterie, the Guardian columnist, were amping up the idea that Labour had a decent crack at getting the Westminster and Wandsworth councils.
Mm-hmm.
And they did make some inroads there, but both those councils remained with the Tories.
Mm-hmm.
They
were suggesting that they were going to get the Westminster council, and that's never going to happen.
Yes. I mean, but then, you know, no one thought that they'd stand a chance of gaining Canterbury in the general election, and they still managed that.
Yeah. I was listening to the New Statesman podcast, and they had the lady on from who runs the Labour list, and she was saying that it was really difficult for her kind of like campaigning and also covering it from a Labour perspective, because there was no kind of like expectation management. It was just like, yeah, we're just gonna win like everything. And then when the people were pushing back and being like, no, but where should we actually be focusing all of our resources? Where can we actually win?
Well, there was a senior Labour person who, I can't remember which journalist this was briefed to, but said something very bitchy about like sort of online, like people being bussed into like vanity projects for Pied Pipers, quote, online. And as you say, like resources not being put concentrated in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I was looking this up in like broader terms, and the Tories still have, I think it's something in, he says, scrolling. The Tories still have like 9,000 sort of local council seats around the country, compared to Labour's 6,500, and Lib Dems have 1,900, roughly speaking. So local councils are still predominantly Tory, but to kind of like, it's generally taken for granted that in midterms the national government should lose a lot of seats.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a general trend, and if that isn't happening, as I don't think it happened in the local elections prior to 2017,
mm-hmm.
or sorry, in 2017, then it's a sign that the opposition party, in this case Labour, is going to struggle to actually get the keys to Downing Street and actually form a national government when a next general election happens. That said, there's probably not going to be another general election for several years at this point.
But what if there, you know, we were surprised last time.
We were surprised, but I just think that the Tories have, I think they have very strong self-preservation reasons not to, you know, force Theresa May out.
Yeah.
So unless all the other parties in Westminster, including the DUP, ganged up on the Tories and called a vote of no confidence mm-hmm. in the House of Commons, it seems kind of unlikely to me.
Mm-hmm. There was a lot of people trying to say that because of the Jewish question.
The Jewish question.
Probably shouldn't call it that.
You're referring to the allegations of anti-Semitism within the Labour Party.
I am, right? Indeed. That this would hurt Labour, especially in kind of like a lot of North London seats and places where there was a high
Jewish
population. Yeah. Did that come to any kind of fruition at all?
So this is the thing about Barnett, right?
Yeah.
Like Labour didn't do well in Barnett.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember the exact result. And this was...
They only got... so they came second to the Tories. The Tories got 6,700 votes and the Labour Party got 6,100.
Right. I think that there's a lot of commentators in the media that are very interested in the anti-Semitism angle with regards to Labour.
But the thing is, if you're not... if you're not a Semite, if you're not Jewish, then it's probably just not on your radar and you don't really care about it as like a run-of-the-mill voter.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably even a lot of Jews who don't follow... British Jews who don't follow politics and, you know...
I don't know. I feel like they've noticed...
Well, yeah, but like how many of them, like, given some of the alternatives available to them, do they feel that, you know, the Tories have quite a sort of strong pro-Israeli feeling, which I guess translates broadly into being pro-Jewish as well. Well, do you not think?
I think that that's a very easy thing to spin.
Right, okay. Mm-hmm. But you could also look at the Tories and say, well... Or you could look at Labour and say, Labour does have an anti-Semitism problem, but that doesn't mean that, you know, broadly speaking, Labour is an anti-Semitic party, even though there have been a bunch of high-profile resignations, at least in the context of Labour politics, not, you know, in the context of UK politics as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying that I don't think you'd, even as a British Jewish person, you'd necessarily look at Labour and say, I refuse to vote for you, because some of the alternatives, there's, you know, there's downsides to them as well.
There was also, we were coming off of the back of the Windrush scandal from the government, from the Conservative Party. And I cynically feel like the appointment of Sajid Javid, we haven't actually spoken since Sajid Javid got the job. Good for him. Well done, Sajid.
We managed to post the previous podcast just before Javid was appointed.
Yeah, great.
As Home Secretary to replace Amber Rudd.
And I feel like, I cynically feel like he was an appointment that was kind of meant to quell that kind of first generation immigrant, especially from like the Windrush generation, but also people who came here for the first time from like Pakistan and India and South Asia, to kind of suppress that grievance, I suppose,
or answer it. You can say.
And there hasn't really been a similar kind of narrative around the Windrush scandal hurting the Conservatives very much in the local elections.
There hasn't, but I think that in the wake of any elections, journalists tend to reach for stories that confirm their own prejudices about how, you know, politics works.
No.
And so, in that sense, I don't think the fact that there has been a lot of attention about the Windrush connection means that it didn't have an impact on people voting for the Tories. It might well have done.
Why aren't people talking about the yellow wave, as I called it?
I mean, people like... my impression of like journalists that I was reading of analysing the local elections, where they were like, oh, the Lib Dems did well.
So, moving on.
Moving on quickly. Because for a long time, the Lib Dems were seen as actually being quite good at local campaigning. And that's how they managed to build up a base of like 50, 60 seats before the last general election debacle.
Yeah.
Or was that 2015? No,
the 2015 one where they went down to 8.
Yeah, they're back to 12 now, aren't they?
Is
something
it
like
13?
12, 13. But that they were seen as having built strong local sort of a strong local presence in various areas.
Yeah,
so
they
weren't
loads
national...
of really strong kind of like groups of volunteers who are really willing to give up their time.
So
they believe in the Lib Dem cause and tea parties and all that.
So the West Country, Scotland, Southwest London, and a scattering of like other areas were Lib Dem strongholds. And actually, that's been reflected in the London local elections in that Sutton, Kingston and Richmond are all Lib Dem
now
councils.
Lib Dems,
Sutton was previously, I think.
Utopias.
Have you been there?
I think it's actually the Lib Dems sort of won the local elections in that not much was expected of them, and they did pretty well.
Do you think if they had actually ended up gaining the most seats, if they had gotten like 3 or 4 more and they had ended up being the biggest gainers, then that would have changed, even though it objectively isn't that many more, it would have changed the way that the media decided to frame it?
I don't think so, just because the interest is far more on, say, on how badly Corbyn's doing.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of the story, I think. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if the Tories had been way more badly damaged, that would have been the story. But just the fact that Labour sort of overpromised and underdelivered, mm-hmm. really. I think that is like, it's a sensible way of looking at it, but and it makes sense from like a news angle point of view. But yeah, I mean, as I kind of said at the start of this, I think that it basically just confirms the fact that the Labour and the Tories are kind of neck and neck. There isn't a great deal to choose between them in terms of how popular they are.
Mm-hmm.
UKIP have, as we said before, like, they're in the process of collapsing. It's very plausible that UKIP will not be a party within the next couple of years, or will just be have
or
like
we'll
a couple
be
of councillors.
Like, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And as far as I'm aware, they haven't had a huge impact on local policy anyway, despite having a couple of hundred councillors.
Yeah, and not being able to function.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. In a similar way that Greens, when they get into power in local councils, they tend to kind of collapse under the responsibility of having to do anything.
Mm.
They seem to be very effective campaigners and disseminators of a single message, but not very good at policy.
You're referring
That's
to
my hot take.
The Brighton Council.
I am referring specifically to the Brighton Council, which is or was the first time that the Greens ever had
control
over a council.
They had
total control.
I think they implemented like 20 mile per hour speed limits in a lot of Brighton, which didn't go down very well.
Mm-hmm. And then decided to widen cycle lanes and then protested their own policy because they had to dig up some trees in order to do it.
Right.
That's my favourite story out of the Brighton Green kind of thing. The Greens also ran, by the way.
Oh, they gained a couple of seats, didn't they?
31, apparently. Oh, no, they held 31
well
seats.
Well, held 31.
Went up like a handful.
No, they had 39,
oh.
And they went up by 8.
Oh, great.
But I was actually quite pleased the Lib Dems did well, despite my railing against their Brexit stance.
Mm-hmm. Why are you happy that they did well?
I still like them as a party. I still broadly agree with their views. I just think that they're wrong about the EU thing, which isn't minor, but, you know, in the scheme of things.
As the defining question of our time.
I think that just suggests that the Brexit thing actually isn't that important to me as a case in some ways, despite the fact...
Don't tell people. That's what we've built the whole podcast around, Jimmy.
Yeah, I mean, I think like Cable's stance on Brexit is abominable, but...
He wants to have a people's vote.
Mm.
Why do you hate more democracy?
I don't hate more democracy. You know, I'm sceptical about elites, you know, calling further votes just to, you know,
yeah, so
further their own ends.
It's Uncle Vince.
Jazza is pulling a troll face.
So a lot of the narrative, well, Laura Kunzberg from the BBC's kind of takeaway was that... the decisions that people have made in terms of where they land on the political divide has pretty much stayed the same. And it looks like this stalemate of there being high kind of loyalty to the two main parties and then some fringes on the side has continued through to the local elections and suggested that if we were to have a general election, then we'd end up with probably pretty much the same kind of result. Because there's no real appeal of these parties outside of their main base? Do you think that that's...
I'm sceptical about extrapolating local election results to fit a general election mm-hmm. picture. I mean,
not least because turnout is like half of that.
Turnout is different. And as we saw last time, like the national campaign can massively change how things go.
Mm-hmm. Poor Theresa.
Because people pay attention, people who don't normally pay attention about politics day to day will pay attention during a campaign.
Uh-huh.
And I follow politics, and I wasn't really aware of there being a big kind of local election narrative because, you know, it's disparate elections, isn't it? They're only connected in the sense that they're happening at the same time.
And we mainly listen to national news, and it's very difficult for them to give you, like, local analysis. And there's much fewer local radio stations, there's much fewer local newspapers that are able to actually give people real kind of insight as to, well, who's running before you actually turn up at the ballot box.
Yeah, and I think most people probably voted on, roughly on the basis I voted, as what are my broad values? This is the party that best represents them. Mm-hmm. I will vote for that party.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think you know, makes sense. Like, it's a reasonable thing to do, even if it's a little bit like ham-fisted.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Really, I mean, in a totally ideal world, you'd like look at the record of the people running the councils and see what decisions they've made and think yeah. about policy. But who has the time to do that?
So I ended up not voting in, because you're allowed to vote in two places in the local elections.
Yeah.
And so because I spend my time split between Oxford and London, I had the right to vote here, but ended up screwing up the postal ballot. And so I couldn't vote in London.
Deliberately?
No, like accidentally. Like I thought I was registered for the postal ballot here. It turned out I wasn't, and I would have had to have voted in Oxford in the morning, come down to London and voted in London in the afternoon. And I felt like that was stretching the right to vote a little bit too much.
You couldn't be asked, could you?
I genuinely thought about it. But you have, like, here in London, the fact that it is an all... like, there are only Labour councillors here.
Mm.
And so there is no opposition, and there hasn't been an opposition. And all of the opposition comes from the also-rans. So the Lib Dems are probably the main party of opposition here, but they don't actually have any power. They have to do offline kind of like campaigning, and that's the case in an awful lot of like London boroughs in like the east and the north especially, where they don't, you're not able to kind of really vote on like their actual record, because people will just vote for Labour anyway. Proportionate representation for local councils as well. That's part of my
proportionate
manifesto.
Representation for everybody.
Yeah, exactly. Shall we move on to our favourite topic?
Yeah, identity politics.
Identity politics.
The intellectual dark web.
The intellectual dark web and identity politics.
So the intellectual dark web as
best segue we've ever done.
As like the name was came up with by Brett Weinstein.
Uh-huh. Stupid name.
Yeah, so like...
The dark web is like it's a tier of the internet that you have to download specific things in order to get onto.
Yeah, you need like a VPN and
whereas
other things.
The intellectual dark web is there.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem with it as a name is that the intellectual dark web has been facilitated by the open internet,
uh-huh.
right? Like the fact that anyone can start up a YouTube channel. Like Jordan mm-hmm. Peterson uploads most of his lectures or a lot of his lectures mm-hmm. to YouTube, where anyone can watch them.
Yeah.
But I do think it. So this is one angle of the story, is that actually the internet has facilitated people setting up independent sort of media projects and companies. Like mm-hmm. We mentioned Joe Rogan, whose podcast is like one of the most successful, I think, ever, like it. Hundreds
yeah.
of thousands of people listen to every episode.
Millions, I believe.
And Dave Rubin, who like interviews various figures on the alt-right and just sort of alternative intellectuals, I guess, who might not go down so well in places like the New York Times, ironically. Mm-hmm. So it's easy to access these people, but whether you would like read about these people just as a standard sort of news consumer, I'm not really sure.
Mm-hmm.
Like me and you are aware of some of these guys just because we take an interest in these sort of things. Mm-hmm. But I think something that's missing out in a lot of the analysis of this is actually how important places are like the New York Times for people who don't read beyond the New York Times, if you see what I mean. People who don't have a very diverse media diet.
Yeah, right. Do you think that that's caused by the fact that our own kind of networks and our own ideas are reinforced by the platforms that we actually engage with? So we only follow the people that we want to follow, who probably are going to have very similar opinions to us on Twitter. The algorithm gives us things that they know that we're going to like and agree with on platforms like YouTube and Facebook.
I think in the case of because podcasting is, like we were discussing like before we started recording, like how many new UK political podcasts there are.
There's too many.
Which you shouldn't go and listen to, because this is the best one.
I genuinely think we are. Anyway.
um, But podcasting is kind of, it's kind of taking off. Like, loads of media companies do have podcasts now, but in terms of their general how many like people listen to podcasts on a regular basis in say the UK, of the UK population, what proportion listen to at least one podcast a week?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure it's that high as it goes.
It's probably similar to that of the amount of people that read Dead Tree Press as well, I would assume. Probably less, actually.
I wonder, though, if, like... so people like our parents, like my mum will listen to, like, Radio 4, and she'll, like, read the Sunday Times, say. Yeah. But she doesn't go beyond that. And she's probably a relatively high consumer of news in that sense. So even a lot of people saying, oh, Sam Harris, Jordan Peterson, Joe Rogan, etc., everyone knows about these people. But I don't know that that's true.
I feel
true.
Like most people, if you're in a university, then you know who these people are. Because you've probably non-platformed one of them or something.
Probably. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely like politically savvy people who know who all these guys are. And so I understand that they look at this story and they go, these people aren't being silenced. Like, I read about these people all the time. But I think it's not so much in the case of Sam Harris, but, you know, a year or two ago, no one knew who Jordan Peterson was.
Mm-hmm.
He's a relatively recent phenomenon. And Sam Harris is only really famous because of, like, New Atheism and being one of the Richard Dawkins crew who slagged off God.
And also bashing Scientology and all of those kinds of things.
Did he do that?
Yeah. Okay. They talk about Scientology every now and again. They seem fascinated by it.
Scientology is fascinating.
They tried to leaflet me, and then I tried to have a conversation with them, and then they told me to go away. It was quite funny. I was on Tottenham Court Road, walked past, I had my headphones in, they tried to give me a leaflet, and I went, no thanks, like, automatically. Then stopped, took my headphones out, and I went, so why are you giving me, we're standing out the Scientology church, and they're giving out, like, Dianetics things, so nothing about Scientology on it at all. I'm like,
Dianetics?
Yeah, Dianetics, that's the name of the book.
Oh, right.
That is, like, more self-helpy. And I was like, you're outside the Scientology church, why are you doing stuff about Dianetics? That's, like, if you're trying to indoctrinate me, why don't you do it honestly? Genuinely said it to her, and she went, oh, never mind then, goodbye.
I mean, that's a bit of a dick question.
It was a dick question, but I was like, do you not know who I am?
Probably not. She doesn't watch YouTube.
No, she doesn't listen to podcasts, exactly.
So there's the second angle that came out of the intellectual dark web thing is this point about political correctness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the only thing that really unites most of these people, so it includes like Sam Harris, Jordan Peterson, the Weinstein brothers, I think they pronounce it, Dave Rubin, and also Ben Shapiro, who's a conservative commentator. And you can, Majid Nawaz, who's like a former Islamist who is now a moderate Muslim campaigner. Ayin Hirsi Alan, who's also a former Muslim who now campaigns about against Islam, is probably putting it a bit too strongly. But there's a diverse collection of people here who believe quite different things. But all of them have some sympathy with the view that political correctness and identity politics has made it much harder to discuss things to do with sex, religion, race, and whatever. Do you think that's true?
Yes, but I think it's made it harder for particular people. And I think that the shift that we've seen specifically around identity politics and how we talk about identity politics has been trying to kind of shift the way that we talk about it. So understanding, for example, there is like the criticism of whenever a white person talks about race, they get told that they're privileged and they shouldn't have an opinion on it. I don't think that's necessarily actually...
You sometimes do that to me.
I do sometimes do that to you, because I think that sometimes those of us who are not from the backgrounds that are actually affected by the things that we're talking about probably need to be listened to and probably understand the situation a lot better than we do. And so I think that there's more value from listening to a black person's talking about like stop and search, for example, and how that affects them and how that affects people that they know, rather than us just kind of looking at the statistics and saying, well, actually it decreases crime, blah, blah, blah. But then what does it do for the communities that are actually affected by these policies?
Right.
And I think that shift in whose voices actually get listened to, I think is really important. And it does tend to annoy the people generally straight cis white men who are used to being able to have opinions about everything, it annoys them because they nobody's ever told them to shut up before.
I think that's a bit unfair. I mean, you tell me to shut up all the time.
Yeah, but also sometimes you're wrong. So.
But I think you've sort of said quite a nuanced version of, like, it's worth listening to people who have experiences that you don't have access to.
Yes.
Which is fair enough.
Yeah.
But there is also, it also often trails into a more extreme version of that, which is...
Which is, shut up.
You're white, so shut up. Your opinion is not valid.
And I would agree that that is not a nuanced way of being able to go about discussions.
Yes.
But I think that there is value in the attitude and the underlying, I think, necessity to be able to... actively lift up those voices that probably should be listened to more because historically they haven't been. And very often, especially with young, impassioned activists and students of the like, they will often just go straight to the, you're privileged, so you shouldn't be able to talk.
Yeah.
And they are wrong to do that. I agree that they're wrong to do that. Mm-hmm. But actually, that doesn't happen very often. And I don't think that many people do that when you're having a proper grown-up discussion. Obviously, it happens if you're riling against, like, social justice warriors on Twitter because you're basically looking for a fight, Jordan Peterson. But this is the thing that kind of annoys me, is that if you are encouraging people to maybe listen to a person of colour or a queer person or a trans person and put more weight on their argument, then it's seen as repressing somebody else's speech. Whereas actually, I don't think we necessarily need to do that. We can lift up somebody else's speech and give it the value that it's needed and understand that a white dude's opinion on a black trans woman's experience is probably something that we shouldn't listen to nearly as much.
Possibly. There's another side of kind of the political correctness thing, which is what... I'm more aware of this just because I listen to Sam Harris's podcast, but Sam Harris often talks about kind of bad faith, what he sees as bad faith sort of arguments against his position, i.e. I think a good example of that actually is if you remember James Damore's Google memo, which we read and then discussed on the podcast. And the way that was reported, even you agreed, was very dishonest. And so James Damore... effectively said, like, there's a lot of psychological research saying that there are large disparities on average between men and women, and the word on average there is very important. And these will probably translate into behavioural differences, different choices in the job market. And this was in the context of Silicon Valley's ongoing diversity problem, it's easy to describe, but the way Damore
saw it... The way that they are doing positive discrimination in a lot of tech companies, especially.
Yeah, so it's the fact that, say, most programmers in Silicon Valley are men, and most...
They're mostly Asian or white men.
Yeah, so Asian people are disproportionately represented, actually. I think white guys are slightly more represented than they should be, if it was, you know, if it correlated with the general US population. But yeah, the way that was interpreted and the way that James Damore was smeared in the wake of that memo being released is something that's very similar to what Sam Harris complains about. And I think that kind of attitude is a lot of what is common to the experience of a lot of the people who loosely fit under the bracket of intellectual dark web. I actually think that that's kind of bad faith arguments and sort of kind of skullduggery and intellectual dishonesty and whatever are all kind of part of politics anyway. And a lot of these topics that these people are wading into, and bearing in mind a lot of these people are coming from an academic background, they're expecting
academic in quotation marks background.
No, I mean,
often it's pop science.
No, I mean, a lot of these people do have, like, you know, had tenured positions at universities.
Yeah.
I mean...
You can still be a bad academic if you're tenuring at a university, I would argue.
You certainly can, but, like, these people are as legitimate academics as, you know, anyone that you'd pick, like, randomly, I think. You know, that they've earned their qualifications and they have worked in these institutions. You might think their work is a bit shit, but then, you could say that about a lot of people, including people who would take the opposite position on a lot of these controversial issues. I forgot where I was going with this. But I think because they come from that background and they're entering the political sphere and they bemoan, I guess, the in many ways low quality of debate and the fact that, you know, there's a lot of smearing going on, frankly, mm-hmm. and I think it's true of both sides. But from my point of view, the kind of say the anti-James Damore smearing, the way this guy was Damore was depicted after the Google memo came out was just really fundamentally dishonest. Mm-hmm. And anyone who took the time to read the memo, mm-hmm. which was freely available online, could tell that that was the case.
Mm-hmm. And this, it was very long though, wasn't it?
It wasn't that bad. I mean, you read all the way through it, so it can't have been that long.
Yeah. fair shade.
Yeah,
fair.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think this New York Times article, I think, it's kind of worth reading. It does pick up on something interesting. But do you want to talk about Eurovision now?
Obviously. Whenever you give me the chance, Jimmy.
I was very reluctant to give you the chance, but you pressured me into it.
I somehow managed to turn it into a political story just so I could talk about it.
Yeah, it was a good sleight of hand. So, yeah. So what is the political story here?
So, this year, the Irish entry to the Eurovision Song Contest is Ryan O'Shaughnessy, who is an ex kind of like Britain's Got Talent person.
Contestant?
Yeah, sure, one of those. And he has a very boring song. It's not very boring. Like, it's sweet. It's sweet enough. I'm kind of trying to be like a...
It's an Ed Sheeran type thing.
Ed Sheeran type thing, yeah. Just man and guitar. But then the music video drops, and the music video is two men interpretive dancing in a gay way through Dublin. And the song blows up because of the visual aspect of it. Everybody loves it. It's very clearly the Eurovision fans love it because we're all gay.
How does one interpretively dance in a gay way?
Because it's two men dancing together.
Right. Where's the interpretation in that?
But the style is interpretive dance, so it's a bit, like, swooshy.
Oh.
You know?
Yeah, Jazz is waving his hands. Yeah. Which listeners will not be able to pick up on.
I think, actually, the dancing in the live performance that he is going to be doing at Eurovision and in the video is really quite beautiful. It's actually quite moving. The gay baiting worked. But I kind of have some issues with kind of the way that their decision to come to having two male dancers, stinks of like cynicism.
You said O'Shaughnessy was straight.
Yes, O'Shaughnessy. I believe it. Like it, I googled him as much as I could, and he doesn't seem to be gay.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So we're assuming he's straight.
He's probably straight. Yeah. Right. Probably straight. It is society's default, Jimmy.
But why do you think this is a cynical attempt to sort of stir... I assume to stir up controversy and get attention.
Yeah, so he has gotten some attention. So there's obviously been pushback from Russia where there's anti-LGBT legislation where you can't have gay propaganda put in front of children. And so there was talk about Russia choosing not to air his entry, although it was never really very serious. It wasn't by anybody who was actually a decision maker at the Russian from the Russian delegation.
Was it just kind of media speculation?
It was media speculation. Then some people who had roles within like the Russian kind of like media landscape, but it was never like unless Russia wanted to skip out 2 years in a row, it was never going to happen. And they hammed this up big time. It was like, oh, this should be love is love. Celebrate diversity. This is, isn't it terrible? And more people went to watch the music video.
You're very, very cynical about this.
I am being
this
very cynical about it.
Not the sort of stance I would take.
Yeah, and there's also something. It's kind of difficult for me to put my finger on it, but there's something about the tone and the way that Ryan O'Shaughnessy talks about the selection of the two dancers and how they were like, well, we just wanted to give it to the two best dancers and it happened to be two guys. And I'm like, bull fucking shit. Like, as if you didn't know what you were doing when you decided to put two gay dancers on the stage. I mean, and I wouldn't have, for disclosure's sake, I have no problem with a straight man singing a song that is then interpretively danced by a couple of guys representing a gay couple. But what I have is kind of this disingenuous claim that it was never meant to be something political, and it was never meant to be something like media grabbing.
You'd have to be very naive to think that it
would
be
commented
on.
You'd have to be really fucking naive. And I'm also, I don't have a huge problem with the idea of Ireland having been the first country to ever have a national vote for same-sex marriage, of them being able to celebrate that and then having it kind of incorporated into their entry. I think that that's actually quite beautiful. But the fact that it's kind of being played down by the way that they apparently decided to select them, but then also hammed up when you have any kind of queer kickback from places like Russia or from the Chinese delegation that decided to blur out LGBT, like the rainbow flag and...
You don't mean delegation, you mean TV channel.
The broadcast, sorry, yeah. Mango TV in China. And Mango TV have subsequently had their license to broadcast Eurovision revoked by the European Broadcasting Union. Mm. It's not like this is the first time that there have ever been LGBT themes in Eurovision either. Like, the whole show is pretty damn gay.
It's pretty gay.
Yeah. You're not allowed to say that, Jimmy, as a white.
But it is quite gay.
But it's really gay. It's objectively really gay.
Okay.
We've had Conchita Wurst win in the past. We've had trans contestants who have won. We've had same-sex kisses in the past as well. But there's something about this tone that has really not sat well with me. And I did a video on Eurovision a couple of days ago because I have to. And I decided to cut out the bit where I talked about the fact that I felt gay baited by the Irish entry.
What do you mean by gay baited in that context?
Capitalising cynically on the pink dollar.
Okay.
So putting LGBT themes in a piece of media, specifically so that it caters towards gay people who are interested in it.
Mm. And I don't Eurovision's not I don't th- find it very authentic in general. It's quite naff.
Yeah, it's kitsch. A lot of it is kitsch.
Yeah.
But some of it is beautiful and sincere.
A lot of it is sincerely rubbish.
Yeah, but it's sincere. They try.
They do try. Where are we going with this topic now? Is there anything else you want to say?
No, not really. You cutting my topic.
There is actually one thing that I do want to pick up is the Chinese thing.
Uh-huh.
China doesn't have the same history of homophobia as somewhere like Russia.
No, it was actually the first place to ever have formal recognition of same-sex couples.
So
in like the Qing dynasty? No.
Hmm.
In one of the dynasties, that was a long time ago.
Right, but there isn't the same like pressure from the top to actually suppress homosexuality. Compared to somewhere like Russia.
So there recently has been new legislation in China surrounding kind of like internet censorship and what kind of stuff has to get censored. And there has been interpretation of this new legislation by companies working in China to then decide to censor LGBT content.
Mm.
So a couple of weeks ago, the biggest social network, Sina Weibo, they made an announcement that they were now going to start taking down and censoring political and violent and LGBT content.
Mm.
Huge pushback from the LGBT community in China. It was actually quite brilliant. There was some Western commentary on this that said that protests didn't happen very much in China. That is a lie. And in fact, I think the Chinese are more ready to protest about things as long as it's not like overtly against the Communist Party.
Mm.
They do protest quite a lot,
right?
Like about the environment, or they'll have sometimes it's quite difficult to organize really big kind of like pride parades, for example, are quite difficult to get permits for. But in general, LGBT people seem to be left alone. And when I lived there, actually you feel very accepted. There's very little kind of like violence towards LGBT people in China. The biggest problem is kind of like invisibility, and especially from like families, especially families that have been under the one child policy, when they find out their only son or daughter is gay, it can be quite difficult for families to be able to accept that.
Was that something you worried about when you were moving out there?
No.
You didn't think it was going to be difficult?
I think I was quite naive when I moved out there. I was only 19 years old. But then kind of realised I how much easier, actually, it was to be a gay man in China. But basically, there was this big protest about the Sina Weibo stuff. And then they reversed that that policy.
It's actually vaguely similar to the YouTube controversy where they were... Was it demonetizing LGBT content?
Yes, but that was accidental.
Right.
Whereas Sina Weibo were like in a really cutesy blog post with emojis and stuff. We're like, hi, we're now going to start taking down rainbow flags, lol. That's just kind of like the tone of official documents in China.
I mean, it would seem that if you wanted to censor LGBT content in Eurovision, you would pretty much just have to censor Eurovision.
Yeah, the whole thing.
The whole thing's, as we said,
is pretty gay.
It's quite gay. So, amusing.
But this is the thing. In China, and also in any capitalist society, if it makes money, then they're probably going to be to sway it. So the reason that Weibo decided to reverse their policy was because there was such a huge pushback from its consumers and the people who use the platform. I wouldn't be surprised if Mango, this is a recently breaking story, I wouldn't be surprised if Mango TV, because of the choices that they made in the broadcast this week in the semi-finals, will end up rolling back that policy, or another Chinese broadcaster will end up picking it up. Also, Mango TV is a really bad name for a broadcaster.
It is quite a bad name, but you're kind of saying that market forces, in a way, are forcing companies to liberalise anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like, you know, bring back the American comparison, but in the way that, say, Silicon Valley companies have been really pro, like, gay marriage in the US because they want to... There's pressure for companies to reflect the values of the consumers they're trying to serve.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's also true in the UK and Europe as well. Like, you have Barclays Bank being the primary sponsor of, like, London Pride, for example, because they know that actually those kinds of values are good business, even though, like, you know, kind of occasionally problematic.
But does it... Sort of getting back to the original complaint you had about O'Shaughnessy, how much does it bother you that, you know, businesses are being cynical but still kind of like accepting you, if admittedly for crude,
this kind of rainbow
profit reasons, rainbow washing?
Yeah, there's loads of different
right
catchphrasy terms.
But, you know, like people like deliberately altering their products or whatever
to try and capitalize on like the fact that it's cool to be gay now.
Ish, yeah.
Yeah. They need... I have issues with it when it is at the expense of companies that are perhaps queer-owned, or when, for example, an LGBT-run company or service gets run out of business because Barclays Bank, for example, would have decided to slap some rainbows on their logo. I'm not sure that Barclays are a particularly good example of this. But
there was a bank that had an advert that said, like, he said yes, and it was two gay guys.
Yeah, Lloyds.
Is that Lloyds?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I feel like, actually, it's so difficult, and so much of it for me is like a personal feeling and kind of like the tone of it. Because, for example, that Lloyds advert, where it was one of many different kind of like big points in people's lives. So it was like the death of a loved one, a kid going to university, and people proposing and getting married. And the people who were proposing and getting married happened to be two guys. And I thought, actually, that was lovely because it was part of like a wider kind of thing. Whereas something like lots of different stories that were representative of just life in the UK. Whereas O'Shaughnessy's is... So, like, this is the one thing that this whole performance has, and it's all hinged on this one thing. And I have an issue because the dancers aren't named. It's all, like, under the O'Shaughnessy kind of It's his name on the thing, and it's meant to be like a singing competition.
Would it seem more authentic if there'd been multiple sets of dancers, and you know, only one of them happened to be a gay couple? Would it seem less contrived?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Perhaps I'd be less kind of like slapped around the face by it.
Mm.
But I think that this could have been something like really powerful. I just wish that the Irish delegation and O'Shaughnessy would actually be honest about the fact that they've made a political statement about this, rather than just you'd have to be really fucking naive to get to the last two dancers, realise they're two men, and then not realise that sending it to a competition with Russia in it, that it's not going to end up causing a stir. And then being and saying all of the rubbish of, oh, love is love and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, it's just kind of like, it takes away the... it's as if we're 20 years down the line in like queer liberation, and doesn't take into account the fact that people in Ireland and people in the UK and across Europe have had a really tough time growing up in like homophobic societies, and to pretend that, oh, it's all okay now and love is love and stuff, and not realise that you're doing actually something that could be really powerful, that's the thing that rubs me up the wrong way.
Sounds good. From that point of view, I'm sure a lot of LGBT people would agree with your interpretation there, but as a company, it becomes, or you know, whatever, a business, it becomes very difficult to straddle the divide between accepting the new and embracing the new values and actually not going too far ahead of the game, or just doing it in the wrong way, perhaps with the best of intentions, and it's very difficult to navigate.
I agree, but anecdotally, I think that often the best campaigns are the ones that have LGBT people running them and wide consultation with the LGBT community, and often the most cynical ones, the ones that don't, and the ones that kind of smack of commercialisation, don't.
I have to say that I obviously can't relate to the LGBT thing, but like in general, when companies like try and buddy up to you or like reflect, I always find it very cynical. I never look at it and think that's coming from a real honest place there.
Yeah, well, I had a history with Barclays last year at Pride, didn't I? And that was fun.
What are you referencing there?
I'm not allowed to talk about it.
Okay. Oh, that bombshell. Should we wrap this
Boom!
Up?
Yes. Please leave us a review on the internet. On iTunes, specifically. Just somewhere.
Anywhere on the internet will do.
Leave it on a Reddit thread somewhere. Where can they find you on Twitter if they want to disagree with you?
At JDE Nichols.
Great. I'm at Jazza John, and you can follow the Sentient Podcast. It's sleeping at the moment. At Right Dishonor, if you want to know when it's coming up, put on notifications, all of that kind of stuff.
You can also go to rightdishonorable.com.
Yeah, that's sure. But who goes to websites anymore?
Good question.
Bye.
Bye.